Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the constituencies inside the 72 million who voted for Trump, 70% of whom cling to the delusion that he won the election which was stolen from him by the Democrats. And while the gun-toting white nationalist Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and the crackpot QAnon cultists get a lot of attention, Trump's most loyal and enduring constituency, his silent majority of sorts, remains the Christian nationalists and the religious right. Catherine Stewart, a journalist and author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on American Children, and her latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, joins us to discuss her article at the New York Times, Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. We'll examine how Trump's loss at the hands of secular liberals could propel the religious right to interpret this as persecution and affirmation of their own righteousness, meaning that their unlikely ally may have lost the White House, but the religious right and Christian nationalists still plan to win the war. And the point of conspiratorial narratives and apocalyptic rhetoric is to lay the groundwork for the politics of total obstruction and the return of a legitimate ruler. Then we'll speak with Benjamin Carter Hett, a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and author of The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic, whose latest book is The Nazi Menace, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and the Road to War. He joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times, What a Bunker Mentality Really Means, and how the big lie emanating from our weak strongman in the Oval Office is being disseminated by the Goebbels of our era, Rupert Murdoch, as Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and Mike Pompeo eagerly cater to Trump's despotic delusions. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University, the author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, and Representation and the Electoral College. He joins us to discuss his article at CNN, The Electoral College is Not Going to Give Trump a Second Term, and efforts underway to pressure electors into being faithless by awarding their votes in the Electoral College to the loser. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Catherine Stewart, who's a journalist and author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on American Children, and her latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She also has an op-ed at the New York Times, Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stewart.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I'm trying to get a sense of the constituencies that voted for Trump, given that we know 72 million Americans voted for Trump, 70% of whom in a recent poll apparently believe that Trump won the election and the Democrats stole it. So within that constituency, I'm assuming that Christian nationalists and the religious right in the broadest sense are the biggest constituency. What does your research tell you?
Well, according to the exit polls, which are quite rough at this stage, it suggests that 28% of voters identified as either white evangelical or born-again Christian, and of those, 76% voted for Trump, and then an additional number of conservative voters of faith, perhaps conservative Catholic or ultra-conservative Catholic, also voted for Trump. So what we're seeing is that his most stable cohort, his most loyal cohort, are people who are sort of on the conservative end of the religious spectrum, certainly people who identify at least in a loose way with Christian nationalism or the idea that America was founded as a so-called Christian nation and our laws should be based on a reactionary understanding of the Bible. So it's the religious right, broadly speaking, and it's the most stable cohort of Trump support. And here's the thing about this movement. It's a movement that's not driven by the rank and file. It's really a movement that's a top-down movement driven by a collection of leaders that have a number of policy groups and other organizations. And they really work very hard to communicate the issues that should matter to the rank and file in election cycles. And they turn out the rank and file to vote in highly disproportionate numbers.
Well, one of those religious leaders is Ralph Reed, the head of the Faith and Freedom Coalition and a longtime religious right activist. And in a post-election press release, he said that religious right voters, quote, came in massive numbers, 7.5 million more above the 2016 baseline, which was itself a record. We believe that they're the reason why Republicans are going to hold the Senate. So he's obviously very happy with the results. And clearly, those two runoff elections down in Georgia are very decisive because they will determine who runs the Senate, whether Mitch McConnell will continue to be able to obstruct and render gridlock for another 4 years. So the guy in the Oval Office may have lost the battle, but I take it you believe they're already planning to win the war.
Well, absolutely. And one of the ways that they do it is that they're disproportionately organized and networked, and they know very well that if you can get people to vote on a single issue or a couple of issues, you can control their vote. So they work very hard, movement leaders work very hard to communicate the issues that should matter in election cycles to the rank and file. And they also have these very sophisticated data tools and messaging tools that get out the vote in disproportionate numbers to sort of get a sense of to get a handle on the numbers. I think we can turn to the work of someone like George Barna, who's an evangelical pollster, who noted that the most devoted religious right members of the religious right number only 10% of the population, just 10%. But in 2016, 91% turned out to vote, and 93% of them turned out to vote for Trump. So this really shows that this is a cohort that has disproportionate numbers. And it hits home the fact that this is a movement that really seeks to not win the majority of voters, but really kind of focus on this radical minority. And if you can get this sort of entrenched minority of voters to stand by your side, that's how they are able to win elections. And it really suggests that the GOP is going to remain in bed with the Christian nationalists for some time to come.
Well, at Saturday's demonstrations for the Million MAGA March and Stop the Steal, of course, there wasn't a million. There was about 10,000, even though the White House press secretary, who is a sort of rabid born-again, she claimed that there are a million, but I guess she hasn't read all the commandments about thou shalt not bear false witness. Nevertheless, there was a scene which I saw on video of the Proud Boys all taking a knee, and they were all dressed in their usual kind of battle gear with, you know, bulletproof vests. They had their bulletproof vests on. They weren't carrying assault rifles because the DC gun laws, thank God. But nevertheless, there they were, you know, maybe a few hundred of them, kneeling en masse, praying before they took on Antifa or whatever group was heckling them. So what is the sort of crossover there between the ones that get most of the publicity, like these Christian nationalists groups, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and of course the crackpot QAnon cultists? To some extent, it would seem to me that the people in the broader umbrella of the Christian rights and even Christian nationalists could be something like a silent majority. How would you break down the constituencies?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. I think if you're looking at sort of alt-right groups like the Proud Boys, or if you're looking at a group like QAnon, and then if you're looking at, say, the rank and file of the Christian nationalist movement, if you look at a Venn diagram, there's areas of overlap, but they're not exactly quite the same group. But one thing that you did, you know, refer to at that march is, you know, the taking the knee, the religious language, it's sort of like a conflation of the idea of America as a Christian nation with this sort of conception of militarism and masculinity. This is something that's very emblematic of the movement overall, and you see an awful lot of it. So it plays right into the sort of Proud Boys narrative of, militancy, masculinity, sort of hyper-masculinity, and this sort of religion-infused idea of what patriotism ought to be. So there's a lot of common ground there, even if they're not quite the same cohort. If you're looking at the rank and file of the movement, you're talking about, frankly, a wide range of people with different interests and ideas. People often characterize this as an evangelical movement or even a white evangelical movement. It's not quite right. The movement includes both people who are evangelical, but it excludes many evangelicals as well. So remember, there's many progressive evangelicals in America as well. And it also draws in members of a variety of both Protestant and non-Protestant religion, including some number of hyper-conservative Catholics. The movement even draws support from people and groups that do not identify as Christian at all. What unites them is not so much any theological distinctions, but more of a common political vision. And yes, there's, Joe Biden won the election. Trump was outvoted. I think there were 71 million voters for Trump at the end, and maybe 78 now for Biden.
72 million, and likely to end up at about 80 for Biden. It keeps growing because of California and these other states taking longer. But you point out earlier, Catherine Stewart, that it's a top-down movement, the religious right and Christian nationalism, and that means, of course, that they get their money from a few super wealthy people like the Prince DeVos family, the fracking billionaire, the Wilkes brothers, and members of the Green family who own Hobby Lobby, and they built the Museum of the Bible. But there's also other factors that you mentioned, that the Christian right is in their own bubble, just as people are on the right or inside the Fox bubble, that they get all the information from Christian broadcasting, and that sort of self-reinforces their isolation and delusion, if you will. And then on top of that, you've got this movement underway now, which Mike Pompeo, as Secretary of State, is pushing on a global scale, the idea that they kind of disguise their zeal over banning abortion, etc. They've changed their stripes a little bit. They're using umbrella terms like religious freedom or religious liberty. So explain that a little bit further, if you will, because I know Pompeo is doing that on an international scale and even going so far as to try and ban any association that the U.S. government might have with Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch.
That's an interesting point, and it's really concerning, I think, in the hands of religious nationalists. The term religious freedom has come to mean something like its opposite. It's come to mean the right of people with certain types of religious beliefs to discriminate against those of whom they disapprove, whose very being or views that they disapprove of. And we can see the consequences of this type of so-called religious freedom around the world, where groups have cast, any kind of right of LGBT people, for instance, to have any kind of a public presence as a sort of violation of their quote unquote religious freedom. It's really using the idea of religious freedom as a right to discriminate or the power to discriminate. In the hands of religious nationalists, the term religious freedom has also been used as a way of trying to demand public subsidies. I think that people underestimate the importance of money to this movement. Sometimes if you dig deeper, it's sort of like, it's about money all the way down. I mean, let's just look at how this works in the area of education when they're trying to obtain taxpayer funding for religious schools that have a right to discriminate or teach whatever they want, creationism, or even, sometimes these religious schools that don't have a particularly great record. They just sort of, they're these like fly-by-night schools that are like virtual schools, but, using religious curriculum from like Bob Jones University or Abeka, they say, well, it's a religious discrimination. It's, you know, it's our religious freedom to claim taxpayer funds for our schools. So, and this is happening in all different areas of government, the idea that faith-based organizations should not be able to claim taxpayer subsidies on the same basis as non-religious organizations is cast as a violation of their religious freedom. But here's the thing, this is a complete violation of separation of church and state. The way that the sort of Christian nationalists have cast it, it sort of completely eviscerates the Establishment Clause. And it also reduces to be meaningless any sort of justification for the unique tax subsidies and a legal status that religions have in our society. Religions are treated with very differently from other non-religious nonprofits as well as for-profit groups in our society. They have unique tax privileges and subsidies, and they're allowed to, you know, they don't have to adhere to our same legal code either. They have a right to discriminate because they're religious groups. But it's for that very reason, this is the justification for the separation of church and state. They're treated differently in our legal code and our tax code. And it's for this reason that we should keep church and state separate.
Well, also, of course, you mentioned earlier the alliance, if you will, between the religious right and conservative Catholicism, and nothing could be more stark than putting Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court. The person who's done that, Leonard Leo, is a member of Opus Dei. He's a very close friend of William Barr, the Attorney General, who Opus Dei actually went, even though they're a secretive organization, they actually went to the trouble of sending a press release out saying that Bill Barr was not a member of Opus Dei. But nevertheless, Leo, this one man alone, as the head of the Federalists, has put six of the current conservative majority on that court. So that's an enormous success. And of course, there have been 220 federal judges as well put on the court by, or selected by Leonard Leo. So that has got to be something that the religious right are very happy about. But
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, that's why one of the big reasons why the religious right stands by Trump or stood by Trump is because he was giving them everything they wanted. And I think a lot of the strategy of the movement is, you know, it runs through the courts. If you can get the courts, you can get the rulings you want.
Sure. Well, and he who controls the Senate controls the court. And God help us if there's another 200 of these people on the court. So just in the last minute, though, the point... Well, I think the point of your article and what I hope the audience takes away from this conversation is that there is, of course, this strain of persecution and righteousness in Christendom, going back to the crucifixion of the prophet Jesus. And many of these religious right people are feeling that sense of grievance and persecution that their hero won, but it was stolen by the satanic people on the political left. That's going to live on. And your concern here is, which I share, is that essentially this stolen election narrative and these other conspiratorial narratives and this apocalyptic rhetoric that's going on is laying the groundwork for the politics of total obstruction in preparation for the return of the legitimate ruler, or if not that, the Messiah.
Indeed, you know, I'm not trying to be gloomy. I'm just asking that we recognize that the struggle for democracy will continue, and we should just be prepared for that.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Catherine Stewart.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stewart, a journalist and author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right Stealth Assault on America's Children. And her latest book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into what the bunker mentality really means as the big lie emanating from the Oval Office is being disseminated by the Goebbels of our era, Rupert Murdoch, as Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and Mike Pompeo eagerly cater to Trump's despotic delusions.
Jesus.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Benjamin Carter-Head, a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of Burning the Reichstag, Crossing Hitler, and Death in the Tiergarten, and The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power, and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic, How Hitler Took the World into War. And his latest book is The Nazi Menace, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and the Road to War. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, What the Bunker Mentality Really Means. Welcome to Background Briefing, Benjamin Carter-Head.
Thanks, Ian. It's a delight to be back with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And as you point out, Donald Trump is not a dictator, and he's certainly not Adolf Hitler. But there are similarities with Hitler being in his bunker, ordering imaginary armies to fight fantastical battles as the Red Army closed in on Berlin, believing that he could snatch victory from certain defeat. And you also point out that 4 years earlier, Joseph Stalin was in a similar situation where intelligence reports were telling him of an impending German attack, which he chose to ignore because the news was bad. And then when the Germans attacked across the front, with 3.5 million soldiers, Stalin literally went on a bender, went to the country Dasha, and he was drunk for days. They couldn't do anything about it. Well, thousands and thousands, if not millions, of Russian soldiers were killed in the Nazi juggernaut. So there's plenty of these examples of delusional leaders not facing reality are very real. But to my mind, Benjamin, as much as you can blame Trump for this situation, he is who he is, and he's there in the Oval Office in this kind of stewing in this infantile furor that he has. But what about the Joseph Goebbels analogy? Isn't Rupert Murdoch an equal, if not greater, villain? Because Trump's just alone in the White House. But the Fox propaganda machine is why 70% at least of the 73 million who voted for Trump believe that he won the election and the Democrats stole it, and because they're literally told to think that way.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's an important, it's a crucially important point. And this is usually the case, I think, with some of these people, not to say that Trump is a dictator, because he's not, at least yet, but he does have something I try to point out in the piece. He does have the authoritarian instincts of a dictator. And to your point, he is surrounded by people who, for various reasons, are willing to cater to those instincts, and very importantly, to cater to the delusions, which I think are sort of essential to being an authoritarian ruler. And I think maybe particularly in this case, a very great degree of culpability applies to the people who are facilitating and fostering Trump's delusions, because they certainly know better. You know, people like Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz or Mitch McConnell, you know, you refer to the whole Fox sort of media sphere. These are all people who understand fully well that Trump has lost the election, that his claims of it being stolen or it being fraudulent are just, you know, what happens when somebody with basically zero self-esteem tries desperately to salvage some story they can live with out of the situation. You know, Mitch McConnell knows that, Lindsey Graham knows that, but they are willing to play along, and they are willing to cater to this man's ego at what I fear will be significant cost to our democracy and our political future. And I think that is really reprehensible and basically unforgivable conduct on their part.
But aren't we living through an Orwellian situation here with George Orwell's description of the big lie? Isn't this what's going on now, the big lie that Fox and Trump and Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz and Mike Pompeo and Mitch McConnell, they're all repeating the big lie that Trump won?
Yeah, I mean, they are, in a sense. They are, as a political tactic. You know, I would maybe frame it slightly differently. The case I try to make in my piece in the LA Times is that maybe the closest analogy is to what happened after World War I, when the German military commanders came up with the idea of a stab in the back to explain their military defeat, because for them that was a very much preferable explanation to the idea that they had simply been defeated militarily in the field. If they could push the defeat off onto the shoulders of civilian politicians, especially socialists and Jews at home, which is what they did, then they could maybe save their reputations for some future time when the army could revive. And they did that very successfully. And the stab in the back then took on a real life of its own, and it lingered, you know, well through the end of World War II. People in World War II were very conscious of this story and were conscious of trying not to repeat it. My concern is that this very deliberately launched lie being put out now by senior Republican figures may take on the same kind of life, that this election was stolen and therefore, you know, President-elect Biden will be illegitimate as president, and who knows where this will go, but I worry that this will take on a life somewhat like the stab in the back lie after World War I.
But could they also resort to violence, as the German military did in murdering Rosa Luxemburg in 1919, the socialist leader?
Well, they might. Or, you know, I very much doubt that somebody like Lindsey Graham or Mitch McConnell will resort to violence. But, of course, they are quite deliberately dog-whistling to people like the Proud Boys and all of these other various kinds of right-wing extremists, who are probably very ready, willing, and able to commit violence. And, you know, one of my many worries right now is that we may see this down the line. We may see increasing acts of what would basically be far right-wing terrorism, much as Germany did in the 20s from somewhat similar kinds of people.
And again, I'm speaking with Benjamin Carter-Hett, a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of Burning the Reichstag, Crossing Hitler and Death in the Tiergarten, and The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic, How Hitler Took the World into War. And his latest book is The Nazi Menace, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and the Road to War. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, What the Bunker Mentality Really Means. And I guess, in a way, what we have to look at now is what you have suggested in your article, that we need to understand how and why a country can fall victim to a delusional would-be despot. Two answers stick out: the tribalization of politics and the erosion of truth. Now, the latter is what we were talking about with Fox News, and I don't see that ending very soon, do you? That this alternative ecosystem that Fox and the right wing and Limbaugh, they literally, day in, day out, they tell their followers what to believe. They serve them up an alternative narrative, and it's working.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in fairness, one should note that there's a bit of a divide running down Fox as well. And there are people even at Fox who are trying to do journalism. I think Chris Wallace comes out of the election campaign with a fair degree of honor. But the people they class as, you know, quote unquote, entertainment, you know, the Tucker Carlsons and so on, are, you know, much more culpable of what you're talking about, of spreading lies. And I'm afraid I wish I knew how to fix this problem. I don't. And I don't see it getting better. You know, we've heard recently about how there's starting to be a certain amount of Republican anger, even against Fox, because it's not gone far enough. And similarly, there's a lot of right-wing Republican resentment at some of the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter. So they're all starting to move to more sort of purely right-wing outlets like Parler. So I think what we might see is a kind of doubling down on this whole process of these kinds of media platforms spreading stories which are farther and farther and farther away from any kind of verifiable connection to the rational world, but will probably be eagerly believed by the people who are already, you know, primed to believe these kinds of stories.
Well, this tribalism is relatively new, and I think it coincides with the growth of right-wing media, frankly. And Obama was interviewed on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, and he said the biggest change that he noticed was the fact that even the Republicans who would private the Republican senators who would privately tell him, look, they agree with what you're doing and they'd like to sign on to whatever you're trying to do, but I can't because my base at home will revolt if I do, because they listen to Limbaugh, they listen to Hannity and Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson and Fox and Friends, and, you know, my political career would be over. And I think that's pretty pervasive, isn't it? We're hearing rumors to the effect that a number of Republican senators are contacting their Democratic friends, like Chris Coons and others, and saying, look, we know Biden won, but we simply can't go public and admit it. I mean, it's kind of pathetic, isn't it? But it's also very dangerous.
It is both of those things. You're right. It is pathetic and it is dangerous. It is certainly, there's certainly not any kind of profile in courage, and what they're doing is dangerous. I marvel, you know, just at a sort of human level, I marvel at what happens in the self-respect of these people, that they are elected to be leaders. They are supposed to be people of substantial achievement. You sort of expect someone who becomes a U.S. senator will be a substantial person, and yet they are terrified to cross in any way this, you know, three-year-old in the White House, and they're terrified to cross a base which is ramped up on false information. That is not a very admirable picture of political leadership, and I'm frankly amazed these people can look at themselves in the mirror.
Well, their rationale is, of course, that they don't want to lose their seat, and it's better to, you know, be a current senator than an ex-senator. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
No doubt. But, you know, in a way, it reminds me of what I've sometimes said about wearing masks. You know, when people generally of the Trump persuasion say that there's something, you know, totalitarian or evil or oppressive to them about wearing a mask. And I think, OK, your country is asking of you to wear a bit of cloth in front of your mouth and nose. Be glad your country is not asking you to land on the beaches of Normandy or make some deeper and more meaningful sacrifice. And I would sort of say the same thing to a Republican senator. Look, if that's the worst thing that's going to happen to you, look, you know perfectly well you can go on to a perfectly comfortable, lucrative life as a lobbyist and probably make far more money than you're making as a senator. Show occasionally a little bit of an ounce of patriotism. Show something that shows that you're worthy of the people who have suffered and sacrificed and struggled for this country.
So Trump is not alone in the pantheon of totalitarian leaders and wannabe despots and real despots. He clearly admires Putin. And he had Viktor Orban show up at the White House when he's kind of ostracized by the EU leaders. And Erdogan, of course, he's had these infamous phone calls with Erdogan where he sold out the Kurds and allowed the Turks to use jihadis to massacre the Kurdish leaders in a shameful situation, which is still not quite fully understood, and it prompted the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis at the time. So we've agreed that, you know, there's a tendency to call Trump and the Republicans fascists, etc. Those terms are thrown around lightly, and analogies with Hitler are often thrown around lightly. But he does have a real affection, right, for these other despots, even if he's not prepared to sort of stride out of the Oval Office goose-stepping and with a Nazi salute.
Yeah, you know, this is a whole minefield. And, you know, to me, I wouldn't be leaping right out to say that I think Donald Trump is a fascist. Among other things, if you talk to 10 historians or social or political theorists or whatnot about what exactly fascism means, you're going to get at least 15 different answers, even if you're talking about the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And I think there are limitations to how the political model of Mussolini or Hitler tracks onto the political model of the United States in the year 2020. I'm not invested one way or the other in whether Trump is, strictly speaking, a fascist. What I would say is he has authoritarian instincts, clearly, however you want to call that. And a point I made in particular in my book, The Death of Democracy, is at a structural level, there are some alarming parallels between the kind of basic structure of Republican support for Trump now and support for Hitler in the early 1930s when he was rising to power. And above all, I would say the pattern of a kind of establishment conservative party that knows it can't win elections on the strength of its own agenda and seeks, you know, a political partner that can win elections, even though that partner has a much more demagogic and possibly dangerous agenda. And they make a kind of alliance to keep themselves all in power. I mean, the demagogue works with the establishment to get into power, and the establishment works with the demagogue to keep themselves in power. That, I think, tracks very closely onto the way that, you know, establishment Republicans look at and think about Trump and the base that Trump brings with him. It's a survival ticket for a certain kind of right-wing politics that, you know, pretty clearly polls show couldn't get elected on its own agenda of, you know, deregulation and tax cuts and cutting social spending and, you know, all that kind of thing.
Well, just in closing, it seems that Trump, more than anything, is motivated by money. He's always wanted to be a billionaire, and he's been a fake billionaire most of his career, and most of his business ventures have been disastrous, and he was bailed out by his father, and we're pretty much convinced, and the evidence is still being buried at Deutsche Bank, but it looks as if he'd been bailed out as well by Russian oligarchs guaranteeing Deutsche Bank loans. So we know that he's a wannabe billionaire, but he's also a wannabe celebrity, and he would desperately like the approval of real celebrities. That's why he goes after Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep and others. And the best he can come up with is Scott Baio and this insane rant from John Voight. I don't know whether you've seen it, but
I did see it. Yeah,
it is spooky and crazy. Yes. And yes, talking about it, the Democrats are Satan, and so there's an infection out there in his world. But I don't know whether Hitler wanted to be loved, and that towards the end he was happy to have all of the Germans killed to bring the country down because he felt they'd betrayed him. So how do you, just in closing, how do we judge this wannabe despot and delusional guy in his bunker today in those terms of essentially being this weak strongman who wants to be loved?
I think you put your finger on something really important. The state of delusion that Trump's in, I think, is in some way similar to Hitler's state of delusion in the bunker. But the motivation for power, I think you've accurately suggested, is quite different. I think the key to Trump in all respects as an individual person is his absolutely epic self-esteem deficit and the deep, deep desire to be loved and admired. I think that is behind his reaction to almost literally everything. It's always about that. Hitler had that a bit, but Hitler also had, in a sense, a purposeful agenda that he wanted to carry out. It was, of course, a horrific agenda, but he had an agenda and he followed it. Trump, I think, has absolutely zero policy agenda. I think he's probably incapable of formulating one for good or ill. He just wants to be loved, and everything he's done has been all about that. The way he reacts to people, if they say something nice about him, he loves them. If they criticize him, he lashes out at them. He's incapable of understanding any event other than in terms of, you know, whether it's reflecting credit on him or not. And I think we should be grateful for that, because he is, as you put it, a weak strong man. He's too, frankly, stupid and incompetent and weak to be himself very dangerous as a dictator. I worry what will happen someday when we have somebody operating like that politically who's a bit smarter and a bit tougher. But it's not Trump.
Well, on that scary note, I thank you for joining us, Benjamin Carter-Hitt.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Benjamin Carter-Hitt, who's a professor of history at Hunter College and a graduate and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of Burning the Reichstag, Crossing Hitler, and Death in the Tiergarten, and The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power, and The Downfall of the Weimar Republic, How Hitler Took the World to War. And his latest book is The Nazi Menace, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and The Road to War. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, What the Bunker Mentality Really Means. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into efforts underway to pressure electors into being faithless by awarding their votes in the Electoral College to the loser. Rock around the bunker.
Rock around.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. He's the author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College drawing upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past 5 years. And his latest book is Representation and the Electoral College. And he has an article at CNN, The Electoral College is Not Going to Give Trump a Second Term. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert. And I've been of the opinion, based upon what the number two Republican Senator John Thune said recently, that they need Trump to rile up the base in Georgia so they'll win those two runoff elections and the Republicans and Mitch McConnell would continue to control the Senate. But what you're suggesting is that it's not going to happen. So does that mean, in other words, they can't drag out the denial of Biden's victory until January the 5th when the vote takes place in Georgia? Will that mean on December the 14th, Trump or Trump's people will be forced to recognize a Biden victory?
Well, by December 14th, that's when the real Electoral College actually meets in state capitals across the country. And those 538 votes that have been sitting out there will then be cast. And at that point, we're going to know how electors voted, and that they will likely then determine that Joe Biden will have a majority of Electoral College votes at that point. So, I think by then, all that will be left is the counting of the Electoral College votes in January 6th. And there could be some suspense there if there are any objections that are held, perhaps by Republicans that might, object, saying that there was fraud in any of the swing states that were carried by Biden. So that's a possibility that could occur.
But your guess would be that once the count is taken on by the Electoral College on December the 14th, it'll be clear that Biden is the winner. And would that be clear to everybody, including Donald Trump?
Who knows what's ever going to be clear to Donald Trump? But I do think that by the time that they meet on December 14th, I do not anticipate that we will see too much in the way of potential faithless electors. So there's a lot of conversation right now saying that Trump, he's going to try and get electors to flip in his favor. It's going to be quite a task to get 37 loyal Democrats across the country to change their votes in favor of Donald Trump. So while there's been faithless votes in American history, there's only been one elector, and that was all the way back in 1796, who cast a faithless vote for their opponent. And that's just not going to happen among these, fiercely loyal Democrats when they meet on December 14th. So I think that those kind of scenarios that would suggest that the electors will flip for Donald Trump is just not going to happen.
And there are just 14 states representing 121 electoral college votes that have laws providing for the cancellation of a faithless vote if an elector breaks his or her pledge. But that leaves 417 electors who could go rogue. And of course, this is being urged on, is it not, by the conservative radio host Mark Levin and the president's son, Donald Jr.
Yeah, we understand, and this similar scenario kind of happened 4 years ago, where there were a number of Democrats that were trying to get Republican electors to flip and deny Donald Trump the presidency 4 years ago. They were basing their arguments on the fact that electors, as determined by Alexander Hamilton at the founding, were to be wise and judicious and save us from potential despot, and also to protect us from foreign interference. And so they made the argument 4 years ago that electors should flip. We had 10 electors attempt to go rogue 4 years ago. Seven were successful. Two of them were Republicans, but they fell far short of the number that they needed to deny Trump the presidency. I think this time around we will not see any Democrats change their vote. And in fact, the Supreme Court just ruled this past summer that states can indeed bind electors to the popular will of voters. But as you point out, there's only 14 states that that have some kind of remedy if an elector were to go rogue. The remaining states do not have a way to remove a faithless elector. So my hope would be that 4 years from now, that kind of uncertainty would just be gone altogether. Nobody expects that electors are going to subvert the will of the people. And so that just seems to be a bit like a vestigial organ, like the appendix. And you don't really think about it until it bursts, and then it can cause all kinds of problems. So I don't think that's something we want to see in our electoral process kind of moving forward.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. He's the author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College drawing upon surveys of presidential electors he has conducted with students over the past five elections. And his latest book is Representation and the Electoral College. And he has an article at CNN, The Electoral College is Not Going to Give Trump a Second Term. Well, when you talk about it being a vestigial organ, the Electoral College itself, of course, is a relic. And the more you learn about it and the more we discuss it, the more it becomes clear that there just has to be a way to get rid of it, surely. I mean, it is so prone to mischief. And, of course, we have the ultimate mischief going on now, where a president who has been clearly defeated is, you know, perpetrating the big lie that he won. And he's got 72 million Americans who voted for him. And a recent survey found that 70% of the 72 million who voted for Trump believe he won the election and that the Democrats stole it. So there's an alternative universe out there that could cause a great deal of mischief.
Well, it one of the arguments that proponents of the Electoral College often provide is that it works to prevent election fraud or can isolate election fraud because it's done state by state. But I think one of the things that we're seeing here is that, you know, that argument has fallen pretty flat. Certainly, Republicans are saying that fraud is occurring in several of these states, which there's been absolutely no evidence that any kind of widespread fraud has occurred. But the other side of that coin is that, you know, the Electoral College can provide some incentives for state legislatures to engage in practices that would work to benefit their party at the expense of another political party. And what I think we can see, I think one of the reasons that we're not seeing a lot of Republican pushback on these calls of voter fraud is that it may set the pretext to engage in some voter suppression activities moving forward. That is that, well, we don't want fraud and we want our elections to be seen as free and fair. And so we need to institute more robust measures to protect our electoral process and perhaps to reduce mail-in voting, to reduce the amount of time that people can engage in early voting, to increase the number of states that have voter ID. And so I think much of this isn't about Donald Trump this year. I think this is really kind of a longstanding practice to kind of work on, you know, limiting voter accessibility rather than increasing voter accessibility at the polls.
So in other words, the lie is going to live on that there was fraud?
Well, I think that regardless of what happens on December 14th, regardless of the fact that Joe Biden is preparing to have the second largest margin of victory since, you know, George H.W. Bush in 1988, you know, he's up by over 5 million votes, and that's likely to continue to spread maybe 6, 7 million votes. He's got over 300 Electoral College votes. This is a pretty significant victory in recent presidential elections. And yet, as you pointed out, you're going to have a large portion of Americans that just simply are going to say that he stole it, that there was fraud involved. And regardless of what, you know, happens moving forward, that die is cast. I think that that's something that is going to kind of hang a bit there, certainly among Trump supporters, kind of moving forward, and regardless of what the facts on the ground actually say.
Well, then you'd have to hold Rupert Murdoch and others accountable for spreading these lies, surely. I mean, it's not just Trump who's out there being delusional, but the lies being kept alive by Fox and Breitbart and OANN and Newsmax. I guess this is the current situation in this divided country, that there are two narratives. One is reality-based and the other one is alternative fact-based.
Well, you know, Kellyanne Conway's comment about alternative facts really has been one of the most prescient things that we've seen over the last few years, because it's true. We've got people that are reading out of two different books. And when you're reading out of two different books, you cannot get on the same page. And unfortunately, you know, for a society to be a functioning society, you have to have some mutual trust. And we've got folks living in their own, you know, media echo chambers, their own social media echo chambers. You know, the news side of Fox has been swatting some of these things down. But it's those, you know, once you get past 6 o'clock, you get into that 7-8 o'clock time frame, you know, the sensationalism that exists is just it's really troubling to see that. And then again, as you point out, you know, on the social media side of it, heck, you've got, you know, folks that are now leaving Twitter and leaving Facebook and joining their own social media platform where they can just talk to one another in their own little safe space. And that's just not good. You know, we have to have a good, you know, exchange of ideas. And that's certainly not happening right now.
So let's talk about the lobbying that has been going on for some time to lobby the electors in the Electoral College. And I was in your article, I was really surprised to learn that going back to 1976, when Jimmy Carter won a very close contest over Gerald Ford with just 5,000 votes in Ohio and 3,000 votes in Hawaii, then apparently sometime later, Bob Dole told the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he, of course, was running as vice president on the Ford-Dole ticket. Just a quote from your article, we were looking around for electors. It just seems to me that the temptation is there for that elector in a very tight race to really negotiate quite a bunch. So what happened? I mean, does this go on? In other words, they get phone calls? I don't know. First of all, how do you know who the electors are?
Well, it's really is crazy. When I started studying electors, you know, a couple of decades ago, I just wanted to kind of do the demographics. Who are these people, you know, and trying to track them down was indeed hard. Many of them are listed. They're all going to be listed on each state's certificate of ascertainment. And that is what's sent to Congress. And so you'll get all the names of them, usually on your Secretary of State's website for each state. So you can get the names, But it takes a little bit more digging to get their addresses or their phone numbers and that kind of thing. And so there are people out there that work to do that. And they have done that. And so, you know, there was very little on who electors were, but also these kind of behind the scenes lobbying campaigns that nobody would anticipate occurring after we vote. And I found one in 1960. Also, there was this telegram campaign that one elector was reaching out to other electors saying that, you know, he was a Southern Democrat saying, I can't stomach Kennedy or I can't stomach Nixon. So let's have a third alternative. And so an Oklahoma elector ended up voting for Virginian Harry Byrd. The Bob Dole thing, that he just said that out in public, was fascinating. And then in our surveys, we, you know, electors would literally write on the surveys, I will never serve as an elector again. I received death threats. I received email viruses. People called me at work. It was truly mind-blowing. And every single Republican elector in 2016 was contacted to change their vote. They were sent things like the Federalist Papers. They were sent newspaper articles on Russian interference. They were, you know, some of them were just sent form letters. So yeah, they did not sign up for that. Many of them in 2008, we found that a lot of the birther movement were contacting Democrat electors saying that Barack Obama was a Kenyan and was therefore not eligible to be president of the United States. So nobody knew that that kind of thing was happening, you know, a month after people cast their ballots, that they were still trying to kind of find this last obstacle or last opportunity to change the outcome of the vote. And certainly that will again occur in this election. But I do not think, you know, I have found that a lot of electors do consider not voting the way they're supposed to. Very few go through with it. And I do not suspect that there will be very many Democrats that will do that this time around. There may be a Republican or two that cast a faithless vote, maybe to bring attention to a pet issue. Maybe they say there was fraud and that's why I'm going to cast this faithless vote, so I have an opportunity to talk about it. Or we could see it maybe a Republican elector who wants to signal support to a different Republican in 2024. That possibility is there. It won't affect the outcome of the election if it's a Republican that does it. And again, I don't suspect too many Democrats are willing to pull the trigger for Donald Trump or anybody other than Joe Biden.
But just to point out how rife this lobbying behind the scenes has been for the longest time, as you point out in your article at CNN, the Electoral College is not going to give Trump a second term. In 2008, when Obama was running against John McCain, 83% of electors were contacted and urged not to vote for Barack Obama. Obviously, it didn't work, but the fact that it happened is pretty alarming. And again, it makes you wonder, why do we have this Mickey Mouse, you know, Electoral College? They're so prone to being gamed and manipulated.
It is shocking. And one of the arguments that was brought up, and again, there's 417 people that there's no legal recourse to cancel their vote. But it was brought up this past summer in the Supreme Court case on faithless electors. You know, they spent a lot of time talking about, well, what about the potential to bribe an elector? What if a foreign government bribed an elector to vote a certain way? What if a candidate bribed an elector to vote a certain way? So that was a point that the Supreme Court certainly probed. And I think that's part of the reason why they said, yeah, if states want to bind an elector to the popular vote, then they can. But to my knowledge, no states have enacted new laws after that case to do so. And again, if I had my wish, you know, short of kind of, you know, overhauling the Electoral College itself, at least to remove, you know, take that appendectomy of sorts and remove the possibility of faithless electors for 2024. Because again, nobody anticipates that after we vote that these types of shenanigans would occur behind the scenes and plots to kind of change the outcome that everybody would expect from the November election.
Well, there is, of course, the Interstate Electoral College Compact that does bind the Electoral College electors to the popular vote in that state.
Yeah, and that is, you know, because the obstacles to kind of have an amendment to change the Constitution toward a popular vote, which, by the way, in the late 1960s, there was a lot of support for. 80% of Americans supported it. We had 330-some members of the House of Representatives vote to move to a popular vote. It was filibustered in the Senate. So there have been pretty significant movements to abolish the Electoral College in the not-so-distant past. But this National Interstate Vote Compact is yet another means to do so without passing that hurdle of a constitutional amendment by having this compact of states devote their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote once they have enough states that make up 270 electoral college votes. Right now they're at 196. I think it's still a very tall order for them to get to that 270 vote threshold. They would certainly need some bipartisan support to do so. It's hard to see that happening in such a divided partisan era.
Well, Robert Alexander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. He's the author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, and his latest book is Representation and the Electoral College. And he has an article at CNN, The Electoral College is Not Going to Give Trump a Second Term. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past. One more light goes on.